Another in our Nussbaum Family Medical Ethics and Halacha Institute programs. And thank you again to the Nussbaums for dedicating our medical programs. The topic for this evening is bereavement and the medical professional. Initially, we called it medical bereavement and the physician. That was just to make it fit on the flyer in one line. It wasn't specific to physicians. It does indeed involve medical professionals in general. I'm grateful to Shari Shamayim for hosting the program once again. Those who have cell phones, if you could please silence your cell phones, that would be great. The class materials are over there on the table, as are the sign-in sheets. Please make sure that you sign in particular if you want credit for the session, but just in general, it allows me to be able to send you a follow-up email after the session with a link to the audio, as well as follow-up on questions that come up during the session. On the sign-in sheet, you'll see that there are three columns. One is for your name, one is for your name, one is for the email address, and then the third one is if you want to get general email about our programs beyond the medical ones. If you check up with that box, then you'll get those that information as well for programs from Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, my program. In the next, I'd say 1 to 3 days, God willing, I'm going to send you a follow-up email. It's going to include a link to an online evaluation form. Please fill out the evaluation. If you're not a medical professional, you can skip the questions about how this has affected your practice. Or you can fill it out, I guess, if you like. But it's important that we get people filling out the survey. It's part of our accreditation process through the University of Toronto. Our next session is actually not for a while, because we had a December session, a January session, a February session, and then we're getting to Purim and Pesach. So our next session is going to be May 11th, God willing, here at Shai Shemayim, 7:30 p.m. If you're on the email list, you'll get information about that. The topic is dental emergencies on Shabbat. You'll hear more about that getting closer to then. As of now, that has the standard CME accreditation as well as dental credit, the Category 3. But I'm going to work on getting an upgraded dental credit for it as well, if that's achievable. But our topic right now is bereavement and the medical professional. So I gave you questions at the top of the first page. These questions largely come from questions I received from people on the email list for these classes. So if there's something that you want to see addressed in a future session, make sure that you email me, because that's the best way to make sure it's addressed. In fact, this topic in general, the bereavement topic, was requested by people, and that's why we're doing it. So the first question is this: Norman, a psychologist, loses his father. On the third day of Shiva, Robert calls his home. Norman has been treating Robert for anxiety on a weekly basis for 6 months. Robert, the patient, reports an increase in anxiety this week due to an emergent situation at work. May Norman spend an hour working with Robert on his anxiety? May he conduct the session in a more suitable environment outside the Shiva house? What's the issue here? Why are we asking this question? Leaving the Shiva house, interrupting the Shiva process in general. As we're going to see, generally speaking, Shiva is supposed to be an immersive experience in which one does not engage in other activities. On the other hand, the tension on the other side is you have a patient and the patient has a need. And the imperative for the doctor to make sure that the patient is taken care of is very significant. And in particular here, you're talking about seeing somebody for anxiety. He has an increase in anxiety this week. So there's a potential need for the medical professional to take care of the patient. So that's what we're going to talk about as our first item, and I'm going to come back to discuss it more when we're up to that. I'm also hoping to discuss some other issues that have come up that relate to that, such as somebody asked me about missing Kaddish. What if you're seeing patients and as a result need to miss saying Kaddish? How would that be viewed? That's another example of that. Ellen?
I have an old version of the handout.
You have the email one.
Is there a deliberate reason?
Okay, fine. I will cop to it on the recording. The answer is you bet. I thought I was being a good guy, but I wasn't a good guy enough, or enough of a good guy. I try very hard to avoid biases as I prepare these, and I try to be balanced, which isn't easy when you deal normally with Jewish text, because remembering that in Jewish text, the Hebrew pronouns are gender specific, and that the standard Hebrew pronoun tends to be male. The inclination is always for it to be males in the cases, so I try to be very very balanced in it. And so what I did was, and I set up the vignettes, they're basically three vignettes. It comes out to four questions, but there are three vignettes. And so for the first one, I had it being a female physician, and for the second one, I had it being a male, and for the third one, I had it being a female. And I sent it out, and I got feedback from somebody that the first one is a psychologist, the second one is a heart surgeon, the third one is a hospice nurse, and it fits the stereotype that the psychologist is going to be female, and the heart surgeon is going to be male, and that the hospice nurse is going to be female. So I said, fine, I'm switching it. So yes, you have a collector's item if you have the one that I sent out by email. I can autograph it for you later. But that's where that came from. That's what it's about. I want to make sure that I'm clear here. I'm telling you the story just because I found it to be an amusing story, but I do think it is important to make sure that you avoid that kind of bias. I have, thank God, two sons and two daughters, and I want them all to feel like they can go into the professions that they want to go into. So I believe in the concept of making sure that it's balanced, even though in this case, really, I was doing the best I could. So, okay. But that's your first vignette. Second one. Sally, a heart surgeon, performs a triple bypass on Uziel. Yes, originally it was Norman. Sorry. So it's not funny for Uziel, in the case. So 3 weeks later, Uziel passes away. Sally receives an email from Uziel's son, notifying her of the funeral and Shiva details and implying a wish to see Sally there. Is Sally obligated to go to the funeral, to the Shiva, both? Gut reactions? We're going to talk more about it, but gut reactions to this? No obligation. I'm seeing a lot of head shakes saying no. I see a non-physician who's not so sure. Menschlichkeit is a nice thing, but we're going to talk about this because it's a very serious issue, and it's one that's discussed in general literature, this issue of medical professionals attending funerals, memorial services, communicating with the family afterwards. It's a very real issue. The third item, Uziel's death in question two stemmed from an unanticipated surgical complication. Sally does not feel she could have done anything differently, but she did fail to anticipate and plan for this complication, and she does feel guilty. How would Jewish law speak to Sally's situation? So you were the surgeon. Patient didn't survive. Triple bypass is a very significant operation. Lots of things can go wrong, having nothing to do with any fault of the surgeon. At the same time, she feels guilty. How would Jewish law speak to her situation? Is there some level of blame for Sally in this situation? And then the last one, Sam. I chose a gender neutral name for this one. I figured you got female, male, gender neutral. Sam, a hospice nurse, is often present when Jewish patients pass on. Must Sam tear kriya ritually? Is there an obligation for Sam to tear kriya if Sam is present when the patient passes on? I see a head shake. No. So Cheryl says, I thought, and that's what most people believe, that in fact it's only family. However, as we are going to learn, Jewish law on the books is anyone present at the moment of death is supposed to tear kriya. That raises serious challenges if somebody is working in a setting where they're going to encounter this sort of thing. So again, this is something we have to talk about. Those are the issues I want to address. And again, there are a lot of other issues that I want to talk about along the way, but I felt those sum up the major issues that we're going to be looking at. I gave you the learning objectives right below that. By the end of the session, participants will understand the challenges posed by personal bereavement for the observant Jewish, should say physician, not physician, understand the ritual and teachings present in Judaism for medical professionals who experience the loss of a patient. Okay. So, the first issue here is clearly one of a tension between caring for the patient and taking care of one's own rituals of bereavement, rituals of mourning. On a personal level, there is the need to care for the patient and the need to care for one's self. We talked about that a little bit a while back when we had a session in which we talked about physician vocations and the issue of, in Jewish law, I have a mitzvah to perform, taking care of patients. How can I take time off for myself? And then on the other end, how could I not take time off for myself? You know, I'll suffer for it, and in the end, my medical practice is going to suffer if I don't. So you have that on a personal level. And then, on a level of Jewish law, there's a need to care for patients versus the prohibition against distracting from the grieving experience. Or, as we'll see, the duty to say Kaddish as well. So what will people say? Does the physician treat the patient, in the case that I gave, the psychologist, does the physician have a session with the patient in the Shiva house, outside the Shiva house? Does the physician refer the patient to somebody else? What does a medical professional do while sitting Shiva? What would you say? Yeah.
So I don't know, but you don't have to necessarily go to an office. You can just go to a quiet room in the house and just do a phone session.
Mm-hmm. So possibly just staying within the house, but having the session, you know, during Shiva. Okay, Cheryl?
Isn't people who are Kaddish, like that interrupt, isn't her patient suicidal? They're just feeling very anxious and need some, you know, someone to hold his hand.
Right, so right, so Cheryl makes a very important point here about pikuach nefesh, about life-saving. We're not talking about a case in which it's clear that you're saving somebody's life. If it's clear that there's a danger to life, then run and do it, and don't ask questions, just do it. But dealing with a case where you have somebody who has some level of need, it's a significant need, without hitting that point. But I also chose the psychologist specifically because I wanted the personal connection between the doctor and the patient. In other words, if you're a family physician and they say my throat hurts, you can say go to a clinic. With the psychologist, it's not so simple to make that statement. Yes.
Depending on what you're saying, let's say Norman works in a clinic he must have some kind of contingency plan. He's unavailable.
Yeah.
So obviously, it's difficult to put a plan in place for an unexpected death, rather than I knew I was going on vacation since the beginning of the year. So if he has somebody else he can refer his patient to.
Right. Right. So you're arguing both sides. Refer, but you may not be able to. You had a question?
So I just heard along those lines. I was going to say that in most situations you should be able to have a backup plan. And I think most people would appreciate if there'd been a death in the family, that they would take those second best option.
Mm-hmm.
Very limited situation, would it be really necessary for Norman to interrupt Shiva?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's definitely a potential position to say that really the patient should understand and accept the referral possibility. I take one more and one more, and then we'll go on. Yeah.
And maybe because as a family doctor, I'm concerned about barrier issues. There, like he has his home phone number, and maybe psychologists do that, but most psychologists I know don't. But I would think it would be rather hypocritic of a patient to if they know that you're. Maybe if he didn't know and explained, I'm saying Shiva for my father. I think most patients, it's just a bit of anxiety, but maybe say, okay, I think I can hold back.
Mm-hmm.
And if he can, then if he's suicidal, I can understand you have to
right.
go. But hopefully the patient is understanding to wait a week until he's, it's not like he's waiting a month.
Right. So the possibility of, again, referring or saying, wait a little bit. Certainly, we do hope patients would understand. In terms of how the patient ended up with the home phone number, who knows? The internet's a wonderful place. Dr. Nussbaum.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's patient may feel uncomfortable coming into a place where there are other people, because many patients of that type, there are very concerned about privacy and things like that.
Mm. Right. So the possibility of having this site, if you do a phone session, then obviously that's mitigated. But you're right. If it's going to be in person, for them to walk into the Shiva house and have them go with you to some other room, that would be pretty challenging. I think that will be very difficult to do. So let's look at some sources on this. First of all, take a look at source number one. Passage from the Talmud defines the periods of bereavement. Shlosha Yamim Lebechi, the passage begins. There are 3 days for crying. The first 3 days of Shiva are designated in the Talmud as days of weeping. Then seven for eulogy. That doesn't mean three plus seven. It's three within the seven, but the broader seven, the Shiva, for eulogizing. 30 for pressing and haircuts. That's talking about grooming, pressing one's clothing, taking a haircut. And then from then on, God says, you are not more merciful than I am. Meaning I gave you mourning periods, that's what you ought to have, but don't do too much. And there's literature within the Talmud itself about making sure that one does not exceed the prescribed periods of bereavement. Based on that, based on these rules, which are taken to be prescriptive rather than descriptive. In other words, it's not a description of people tend to cry for 3 days, people tend to eulogize for 7 days. It's a prescriptive thing. It's saying, take 3 days, as days of crying, take 7 days as days of eulogy. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says that during Shiva, one should really devote oneself to the crying and eulogy experience and not engage in other things. So I brought you in source number two from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. These are prohibited for a mourner, the following activities, and the very first one is work. And when it says work, it doesn't mean the Shabbat's definition of work, the 39 categories of creative tasks that are prohibited on Shabbat. A mourner is allowed to flip a light switch. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is work, as in what people do for a living. Those kinds of activities that will necessarily distract from the grieving experience. So just with that, I would look at it and say, so tell the patient, I'll see you in 7 days. That's the way it goes. Or give the patient the option of calling the associate or whoever it is to whom you can refer patients at that time. However, we have plenty of precedent within Jewish law for overriding mourning, including Shiva, for other concerns. So for example, the most obvious example, Pesach, Passover is coming, it's not that long, not that far away. If someone suffers a loss 3 days, 4 days, 2 days before Pesach, before Passover, what happens to Shiva? It ends. It's cut off. Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch explains, national celebration overrides personal grief. It can be a very hard thing for people to deal with, but the idea is that we don't say that personal grief is the be-all and end-all. There are things that, in fact, supersede the personal grief experience, and therefore, as well, we have, as a matter of Jewish law, that if somebody has a relative who's very sick, and then the person who has the person who's not sick, and let's give names. So Judy has a relative named Samantha, and Samantha is very ill, and Judy is now sitting Shiva, but Samantha, who's very ill, is a close relative and would be shocked if she wasn't visited by Judy. The rule is that Judy goes during Shiva to visit Samantha. Not only that, but she's supposed to take steps to cover up the fact that she is in mourning. So she wouldn't wear the clothing that she tore, for Kriya. If it's a man, they would shave in order to make sure that they not upset the patient by letting them know about the death and the mourning, if that could potentially worsen their situation. So again, an example of overriding the Shiva experience for the sake of somebody else, for the sake of a superseding concern. So take a look now at source number three, where we find from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, that personal needs may override the Shiva as well. Rabbi Yosef Karo and Rabbi Moshe Isserles are both in on the action in this line in the Code of Jewish Law in the Shulchan Aruch. We begin with the Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Karo, reading my English translation. He says, one may not have others, parentheses, including non-Jews, do his work unless a loss is involved. In other words, somebody is sitting Shiva, and they say, well, I have a business to run. And if you're not going to let me run it, then at least let me go hire somebody, and that person will manage my store or whatever it is. Not allowed to do that during Shiva, unless a loss would be incurred. If you would lose money by doing this, so then fine, have somebody else run it for you. For a loss, a mourner may have others do it. That's Rabbi Yosef Karo, the initial statement in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. Along with Rabbi Moshe Isserles, and he says, some say that if one couldn't have others do it, if it's not that kind of business, you can't get somebody else to run it for you, and a loss is involved, the mourner himself may run the business. And he says, after the first 3 days, one may be lenient, and even during the first three, to prevent great loss. So in the event that there's a great loss and you can't get somebody else, the mourner is allowed to conduct the business during the first 3 days, and there's greater leniency during the rest of Shiva. That's the law on the books in the Shulchan Aruch. The 3 day, 7 day distinction comes from that, what we saw in source number one, the passage in the Talmud that in fact distinguished between the first 3 days and the rest. Yes?
Is loss
literally, yes. Literally, yes, but we're about to apply it beyond that. Literally, in the context of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law, that's indeed what is being addressed. Yes? Right, so most of the issues of mourning in general are viewed as rabbinic, which is why they can be overridden in this way. Yeah, that's the logic behind this. I mean, you could make the argument if you had to, but the easier point is simply to say it is rabbinic, and that's why. So, in terms of the practical question that we're discussing and seeing the patient, that's where we segue from the financial loss to other issues that are involved. But it actually requires a double segue. Number one, you're going from financial loss to instead, in this case, a person's health, that is their emotional health. That's number one. But you're making a second transition, right? In that the Shulchan Aruch is talking about the business owner or physician, in our case, their loss. Whereas here you're talking about the patient's loss. It's the loss of another person. So that's also something that has to be taken into consideration. So take a look, please, at source number four. The Pesach Tshuva, classic commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, quotes the book Chamudei Daniel, who says that for a loss, even for someone else, meaning someone else's loss, the mourner may act. And he says, therefore a doctor may go even during Shiva. The doctor may indeed break Shiva in order to be able to help somebody else. Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, in a responsum written, as you see here, end of the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century, in source number 5, says, regarding a doctor who is in mourning, I have seen that my mentors, permitted going to the patient. Not only seeing the patient in the Shiva house, or phone wasn't an option for him, but going to the patient for possible danger is different. A patient could indeed suffer harm. Now, he's talking about a certain level of illness, clearly, in order to justify it. And he says one could even permit where another doctor is available, even if you could refer, because of a principle that we find already in the Talmud, which is one may not merit healing from everyone. You have a relationship with this doctor. This one knows your situation. That's the one you should ideally be consulting. And so that's the position taken by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, as recorded in the Nishmas Avram of Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer. Abraham is to leave the Shiva house. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, though, adds a note, which is he doesn't want you taking payment for it. He says, this really shouldn't be, it shouldn't turn into something that's being done for economic gain. So they see the patient, but don't take payment for it. So that's an interesting note. But that tends to be practical halacha, meaning I looked at several different practical guides for mourning, and they basically gave the same response. That indeed the medical professional would see the patient if need be during Sheva. Yes, if you have the option of referring to somebody else, and the care is going to be the same, you're not running the risk of harming the patient, by all means. But otherwise, it is certainly justified to see the patient. Yes, Jeffrey, and then Julie. The primary issue is distraction from the grieving. That's the issue. You're asking, in other words, a separate question, not the medical question, but what if someone has a business that they can conduct from the Shiva house? But the answer still is it's going to distract them from the process. If you think about outside of the context of Shiva, right, Tisha B'Av as an example, right, we are taught that on Tisha B'Av, which is a national day of grief and of mourning, one isn't supposed to distract one's mind with other things, including even the study of Torah is considered inappropriate. That's what we're talking about. It's not only about the physical space one occupies, it's also about the mental space, so to speak. Julie?
If the patient had called the psychologist and said, "Hi, you're having a lot of problems, can you see me this week?" And let's say the psychologist is not in mourning, said, "I'm sorry, I do not have any openings, you have to come in a later time." Keep those anxious right now. So if that would be the case, if there's no extraneous circumstances, "I'm sorry, I can't see you right now. If you're suicidal, then my recommendation is to go to the hospital." Then you could say, how much more so is, "Sorry, for personal reasons, I cannot see you right now."
Right.
And maybe just for professional reasons, sometimes you can't.
Right. I think that's an important point, which is the rabbis who are writing about this, I think, are speaking from a place in which people don't defer patients. The assumption is the patient contacts you and the patient is going to be seen and not referred and not told, you know, you can't get an appointment for the next 6 months. I think you're right. I think that they're speaking from a different point of view, and that's why I presented it the way I did, that if you have the option of referring, go ahead. But you have the justification for seeing the patient. Okay. The question which I received by email when I first mentioned I was doing this topic, the Kaddish question. So it touches on something we discussed several years ago. And that was the issue of minyan versus medicine. We talked about the question of a medical practitioner, a medical professional who can't make it to shul for services, is not able to make it to a minyan because they're seeing patients, right? Consider at this time of year, right? This time, now it's already getting later. Mincha on a weekday is 5:30, but if you go back a month or two and mincha was 4:30 in the afternoon or 4:40 in the afternoon, it can be really hard to be able to make that, and you could conceivably be seeing patients or engaged in a surgery from the earliest time for mincha, let's say 12 o'clock, 12:30, all the way through till sunset. And then what are you supposed to do? And now add to it the case in which the physician is saying Kaddish. So in number 6, I gave you 2 links to sessions in which I discussed this topic of minyan versus medicine. And what we're going to talk about here is lifted one piece of that from those two sessions. We have a basic principle, excuse me, which makes it into number 7. It's a passage out of the Talmud, and what it teaches us is Osek b'mitzvah, pater min ha-mitzvah. Someone who is engaged in a mitzvah is exempt from doing other mitzvot. So if you look at the passage right here, the Mishnah says, the core text says, those who are on a mitzvah mission are exempt from sitting in the sukkah. And then it continues to say, we have learned, Rabbi Hananya ben Akavya said, those who write Torah scrolls, tefillin and mezuzot, and their merchants' merchants, meaning I guess you had retail back in the day, and all who do heavenly work, which includes merchants of techelet, the dye that's used for tzitzit strings, all of these people who are creating and selling mitzvah objects are exempt from saying Shema, the Amidah, Shmona Esrei, Tefillin, all biblical mitzvot. Biblical mitzvot, they're exempt from it. As Rabbi Yossi Aglili said, one who is involved in a mitzvah is exempt from performing another mitzvah. And that's a basic principle. That's a basic rule. It doesn't always apply. One should not over-apply this exemption. So that, if you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, says, if these scribes and merchants need to do their work during Shema and the Amidah, they're exempt from Shema, the Amidah, and Tefillin. One who is involved in a mitzvah is exempt from other mitzvot if he would need to strain to fulfill the other mitzvah. He says, back up a step. What if you could do both? It just takes work, right? You'd have to finish with a patient and then race to be able to get to shul. You'd have to restructure your schedule so that you would, let's say you would leave, go catch mincha, and then come back and see the patient after that. So the position of Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch is that even if strain is required, you have to strain to fulfill both. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, whose word is generally followed by Ashkenazim, says no, if there's a lot of strain involved, you don't have to do it. But if you can do it without strain, then you would be obligated to perform both. But that's one note. Second note is source number 9 from Rabbeinu Nisim. He deals with a case in which you are returning somebody's lost property. You are walking in the street, and you notice someone's wallet on the ground. And you say, oh, I know whose wallet that is. And you pick it up to return to that person. From that moment onward, you are engaged in a mitzvah. You are restoring somebody's lost property. And therefore, you're exempt from everything else that comes along. So, can that be? Does that now mean that in the case that the Talmud asks, I found someone's wallet. I'm holding on to it until I see him. Someone comes knocking at my door and they're collecting for tzedakah. I can say, sorry, I'm exempt because I'm engaged in the mitzvah of returning this fellow's lost wallet. When are you going to see him? 2 weeks. Is that really an option? So Rabbeinu Nisim says no. You're only exempt when you are actually doing whatever it is, when you're engaged in the mitzvah. If you put the wallet in your safe at home, you're not guarding it, you're not returning it, it's just sitting there, then you're not exempt from the other mitzvah. There's more to talk about on that, but that's a basic way to state it. Also, if somebody is engaged in the mitzvah for the sake of payment, then the rules change. Then they're not exempt from other mitzvot. If I'm engaged in a mitzvah that's going to cause me to get paid, I can't say, well, that's the mitzvah I'm doing as opposed to the other one, because that's the one that's going to bring remuneration. That's not an option either. But to apply it to our discussion, one who is treating a patient is indeed exempt from other mitzvot at that time. Let me just make sure this is clear, because I realize I didn't state this explicitly. When we talk about being exempt from mitzvot, what we mean is exempt from commandments, active mitzvot, not exempt from prohibitions. Meaning you can't say, I'm seeing a patient now, therefore I'm going to go have a cheeseburger. Right? That doesn't work. It's an exemption from commandments. From go do type of mitzvot. I should have said that from the get go. So the rule here is that if you're seeing the patient, you are indeed exempt from other mitzvot while seeing the patient. If you take a look at source number 10, actually, I'm not ready for number 10 just yet. Sorry, Rabbi Avram Sofer Abraham. Quote Rabbi Yeshua Neuvert, who was the author of the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa and a significant authority in Jewish law, that don't assume this only applies when you're seeing the patient. It involves other medical activities as well. Now take a look at number 10. He says, I have heard from my master, Rabbi Yeshua Neuvert, that a doctor is exempt from prayer not only when he's examining or treating a patient, even without danger to life, but even when he's writing in the patient's record, even when he's writing release documents. All of this, assuming it has to be done then, right, that issue of strain and moving it to another time is still a factor, but all of this constitutes involvement in the mitzvah. But the doctor's going to get paid. That's what you ask Andrea. What about the doctor being paid? So I refer you to source number 11, where Rabbi Dr. Avraham Sofer Abraham quotes Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein. Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, son-in-law of Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv and a significant authority in Israel today, says even though doctors and nurses are paid for their work, still, they're like people returning lost objects. There is no greater restorer of a lost object. Since he does not think about profit at all while working, but is only involved in healing the patient and his care, or that of a nurse, is the mitzvah itself. He has that of a nurse is in parentheses in the original Hebrew. It kind of disrupts the flow of the sentence. His care is the mitzvah itself. He has the status of one who is involved in a mitzvah. In other words, yes, it's true that medical professionals get paid. However, that's not what they're thinking about when they're seeing patients. I'm taking that as a given. Because it's not what the focus is, we don't consider the fact that they are paid something that's going to take away from their something that's going to take away from their status as being exempt from other mitzvot. So therefore, indeed, they would be exempt. First of all, we said they're exempt from prayer. Definitely, then, they're exempt from Kaddish. Now, I should note here, because I just remembered that I skipped one thing in my introduction. I apologize for skipping in my introduction. I see a lot of people here already know what I'm going to say, which is nothing that I'm saying here should be taken as practical halachic advice. We are discussing important issues. I am saying what I believe emerges from my research, but I do want people to please consult with their rabbis as far as practical guidance should this, God forbid, come up for people. Yes?
So I was going to ask, who interprets all these exemptions? Is it the individual? The mourner?
You mean the exemptions in terms of like if they could do something else? Yeah. So this is a basic tenet of how Jewish law works, and I thank you for asking the question because it gives me an opportunity to talk about this. The question was, who exactly interprets these exemptions? How do you decide whether there is strain involved, there is not strain involved, and so on? The way Jewish law works is that it expects the individual to figure these things out. Meaning Jewish law is not written for rabbis. Jewish law is written for the individual Jew to be able to go through the sources, to learn the material, and to apply it. Rabbis are useful because not everyone is necessarily able to go through all of that and figure all of it out, and because sometimes you need an objective voice. Somebody who isn't in the middle of it and can look at it and give you some outside perspective. But at core, in terms of how this is meant to be applied, it's meant to be the person says, yes, this involves a lot of strain. No, this doesn't involve a lot of strain. And it's an assessment that's made on an ongoing basis. Meaning, let's move away from the bereavement situation. The rule is that one is supposed to daven Maariv, right? Evening services. People are supposed to pray them on a nightly basis. Ideally, you do that with a minyan. Okay. What if a person is just exhausted? They can't make it. They just can't do it. Can they do it at home? The answer is yes. But now, how do you evaluate how exhausted am I? Right? Last night, I had a class in the Clanton Park area. It ended at whatever it was, 9:10, 9:15. It was snowing outside. I would have liked to have gone home rather than go to the 9:45 minyan at the bayit. It's a real calculation. You're tired. The answer was, in the end, just go to the bayit before you go home. That way, you'll actually do it, because otherwise, I would never have left the house again to go back. But this is the kind of assessment that Jews are expected to make. That's the way the system is supposed to work. And the rabbi is there as a safety net in the event that somebody wants the outside calculation. Okay. So that's in terms of the Shiva question and the Kaddish question. Let's move into the next case. And the next case is dealing with the bereaved families. So going back to the second vignette. Sally, a heart surgeon, performed the triple bypass. I'm not going to read it out word for word. You saw it. We read it out loud already in the beginning. And the patient passed away. There was some kind of an unforeseen... number two. The patient passed away. The family notifies the doctor of funeral and Shiva details with some kind of implication. We'd love to see them there. However, they managed to say that. Is the physician actually obligated to go? Because we do have a very strong mitzvah of chesed, of taking care of others. So before we get to that question, I just wanted to note something that I saw that I thought was very interesting. In number 12, the fact that it's not translated on the sheet is not on purpose. It's because I missed it when I was going through, and I apologize. I might do a translation before I send out the source sheets in the follow-up. Somehow or other, I missed doing that translation. But I'm going to read it out now and explain it. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, who, remember, is not only a leading rabbi, but he was also, for a very long time, the head of internal medicine in a unit at Shaare Tzedek Hospital in Israel, so he speaks with knowledge about this, talks about the importance of care when conveying the news of a death. And they, he actually quotes sources in Jewish law, which say you can't tell people that a relative of theirs passed away, which, you know, leads to certain complications. The patient passed away in the hospital. What do you expect to have happen? How will there be a funeral? How will they do what they need to do? So he writes the following. I'm going to do a translation of the lines here. You can follow along in the Hebrew if you wish. He says, "Me'od me'od." He says you have to be very, very careful in the form and the language that you use to inform someone that their family member has passed away. He says it can cause shock to them. The word helem there is a reference to shock. It could even cause a relative to pass away, just like any other bad news, he says, can cause some level of trauma. If someone's ill, it can be destructive. And he gives you examples that are found in Tanakh. Eli, the Kohen Gadol, hears that his two sons have died, and he dies as a result of that news. The Medrash about Sarah, that she dies when she hears about Yitzchak, about her son. And then he says, if a patient in the hospital dies and there are no family members present, he says, don't inform the family by telephone, but rather summon them to the hospital because the situation is bad. And then when they're in the hospital, tell them little by little when you're face to face. Now, I don't take the advice he's giving here as word for word, this is a matter of law, what one must do. I take the message as the important part, which is to really have that level of concern. I think people do naturally. But just to make sure that the information is conveyed in a way that, to whatever extent one can, the shock is minimized. That's just something that I saw as I was preparing this, and I thought it worth mentioning here. Comments on that before we move to the funeral and Shiva question. Julie.
I have a situation working in the hospital, so I'm going to call you to mind when I was working that night. Family member died, and the nurse calls the survivors, but because it was traffic, by the time they got there, that the nurse with whom they had a relationship and who had been looking after the patient had gone home. The family comes, walks into the room, finds the dead body, then comes to the desk and says, "What on earth happened? We were told there was an emergency."
Yeah.
So I get what he's saying, but there has to be follow-up. If the family cannot... And so with the, I haven't done it, decided, you know, well, girl or dad, I'm not going to come, I'll see them at the funeral. I promise you people about this.
I don't doubt it.
I don't know, just in my experience, it's doing someone a disservice to not say why you're calling them, especially if the death is expected.
I think a degree of seichel, a degree of sense has to be used when applying this. I think there are cases where this will work and there are cases where this will not work. You know, you may also have a situation in which the family member is not a particularly close family member, just happens to be the closest one. And if you don't tell them why, they may say, you know what, I'll see them in the morning. No, in all seriousness, I know situations like that from when I was a shul rabbi and had direct involvement in things like this. Like, you have to apply this with a degree of sense and awareness of the circumstances. Okay, so then let's move into the question of attending the funeral. So in the medical world, there's been quite a bit of work on this topic. I saw this article, number 13. I thought this was a very good article that discussed the issue. Should doctors attend patients' funerals? So it's talking about Dr. Zambrano, psychologist in Australia. Dr. Sophia Zambrano conducted a research study at the University of Adelaide looking into funeral attendance practices. practices of Australian health professionals. She and her colleagues created an online survey which was answered by 437 doctors across Australia from various different specialties. They also targeted other health professionals like nurses and social workers. However, that is a subject of an upcoming publication. The aim of the survey was to explore how doctors perceive funeral attendance, how often they attend their patients' funerals, and what influences them to do so. What I found interesting is that when the physician attends the funeral, it is not just about that sense of the physician feeling better about themselves and dealing with their emotions, but also that sense of wanting to do something for the family, showing that they had a relationship that was important to them. It's not just about the physician, but for the benefit of the family. It's very interesting to me that Dr. Zambrano starts from the assumption that it's for the physician's sake and says, and it's also for the family's sake. My assumption would have been the other way around. That by default it's for the sake of the family, and then it may also benefit the medical professional. But she goes on to say, for example, the doctor's attendance, apart from helping the doctor cope with the grief of losing a patient, may signal to the bereaved family that support is still available. It can bring some comfort too and give the message that the patient who has died had a valuable relationship with their doctor, which to me is the most fundamental reason to go. Without saying whether one should or should not, to me that's the most fundamental point, is that it underscores to the family that that the doctor cared, which hopefully they would understand anyway. Nonetheless, this conveys it. At the same time, take a look at number 14, which I pulled from an excellent essay, Dr. Danielle Ofri, writing in the New York Times in 2011, she talks about how families appreciate the presence of the medical professional, but at the same time, she lays out three reasons not to go. The little research that has been done, she said little, but the truth is I found quite a bit, suggests that most families appreciate the presence of the loved one's physician. In my own experience, families are quite surprised but usually honored to see the doctor in attendance. I've been proudly introduced to more aunts, uncles, and cousins than I can possibly keep track of. But after the introductions, there's always an uncomfortable gap in the proceedings, as if they don't quite know what to do with me. Yeah, again, yeah, you sort of have to translate this a little bit, because in a Jewish funeral setting, it's very different from what she, I think, is describing. Everyone knows what to do, in the sense that there isn't, at the funeral itself, real interaction between the mourners and everybody else. They come into the room, they sit down, they may give a eulogy, one may greet them on the way out, but it's not as though there's an extended interaction going on in a traditional funeral. Obviously, you know, people do things differently, and there may be other types of funerals that go on, and that, I assume, is what she's more familiar with. In any case, she continues, I feel like a respected guest, but one who causes others to stiffen slightly with formality. I'm careful not to overstay my welcome. Many doctors express a desire to attend their patients' funerals, but it can be nigh impossible to reschedule 20 patient appointments or rearrange a planned operation on the short notice that funerals typically offer. And beyond the logistical scheduling challenges lies an inner core of ambivalence. Now that the medical care chapter has closed, we're not quite sure how we fit into the patient's life. We were so recently actively directing the medical care, doing something, and now we are the awkward bystanders, often abashed by the deference paid by families. So she offers 2 points so far. It's awkward, and it's hard to work into the schedule. But then she says there's a third point. But the deeper truth, I think, is that it's just too painful. Not because we feel the death of a patient is a failure, as stereotype often has it, but because it hurts to keep losing members of the family. It hurts to keep seeing the bodies of your patients, bodies with whom you have been intimately familiar, laid out in stone-cold carriage. It hurts to see the face of someone with whom you've had deeply personal conversation, now rigid with that oddly blank expression. It just hurts. It never gets easy, not even after years in practice. And she's, I believe, an internist at Bellevue Hospital in New York. So, you know, what she's describing is, I think, a set of reasons that are really hard to argue with, right? In terms of the pain, in terms of the practical challenge, and in terms of the awkwardness. I want to show you one more article and then ask you for comment on it. Take a look at source number 15, please. This is a study of studies. on the issue. Bereavement practice is employed by hospitals and medical practitioners toward attending funerals of patients. They reviewed 381 articles on this subject, including cross-sectional studies from various countries. U.S. and Canada, clearly, but Israel, Italy, a bunch of them. That's why I say there actually has been research done on it. So they write the following. Bereavement practices employed by medical professionals included answering or making phone calls, attending family meetings, sending condolence letters. Medical professionals' attendance at a patient's funeral was influenced by medical professionals' gender, age, years of experience, the medical specialty. Perceived benefits of medical professionals' attendance at a patient's funeral included providing support to the family, extending their professional relationship, illustrating respect to the patient and the family, resolving guilt, and personal growth. Barriers to the attendance included a lack of time, blurring of professional boundaries, personal discomfort with death, emotional arousal, discouragement by colleagues. General practice had an attendance rate of 71%. Attendance rates for palliative care, oncology, psychiatrists ranged from 63% to 81%. 7.1%, 67%, and 15%, 67%, respectively. So the palliative care, 63 to 81. Oncology, 7.1 to 67%. That's quite the range. The psychiatry, 15% to 67%. Intensivists had an attendance rate of 22%. You're clearly seeing quite the range. What do you think about all of this? I see a lot of medical professionals who are here. What's your sense of this? Yeah.
In over the years, I have never, I've never regretted going to a funeral. They always are appreciative, and if I can get there, I will go. If there is a death, the family gets a phone call, and if they do tell me that the information, I've gone to non-Jewish ones, and my Jewish patients, I'll try to make a Shiva visit if I can, or attend the actual funeral. Mostly it's a Shiva visit because it's often very hard to go to the actual funeral.
Right.
But they are really, most people are shocked to see you there, but they're so appreciative.
Mm-hmm.
They really. I'm not saying if someone doesn't go, that's okay, because I've had colleagues that are surprised that I go.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it helps the family in many ways to see me.
Right. So I'm hesitant to ask the next question because I don't want to put you on the spot with it. But you volunteered, so I sort of feel it's okay. But what is the experience like on on your end of it? Understanding it can help the family, and I think that it's true that it does.
I think it helps me there's always that awkwardness going in. Oh my gosh, not so much with the immediate family because someone died and they're like, oh, the doctor's here. What did they do? You always worry, are they thinking, the person died? Did you have some part in it? Did you miss something? There's always that in the back of your head. But it goes away quickly because I realize that it helps me kind of put it in perspective and makes me feel better that I've helped the family finish the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, these patients are family, they're still, the family members are still my patients as well.
Mm-hmm. So that definitely is.
There's that. But I can also offer them support, saying, "Do you need anything from me?" And it makes me feel—I actually feel good when I go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I see a couple of hands. All right, yeah, Esther.
To Peter, what you just said—the
Right. I was wondering if that was what was meant here when they talked about, I think it was Dr. Ofer, you talked about it. It was the paper in number 15, extending the professional relationship. the meaning when you have additional professional relationship, when there is the that possibility, as opposed to somebody who just met the patient in the hospital, and that's it. Yeah. So I think that's an admirable position, but at the same time, grief is often about oneself, right? I mean, people who go to a funeral are often sad because of themselves, as opposed to the person who passed away. That they, you know, the person who passed away, Judaism teaches, they are now in another world. They are having their own experience. They're not the ones who are in pain as much as those who are left behind. So that grief is often, you know, unfortunately, or whatever you want to call it, self-focused. So I agree with what you're saying, and I think that it's that there's a lot of validity to it. At the same time, if someone said, it hurts me, I would have to recognize that as legitimate as well. Jeff, or that's between husband and wife. You guess, you decide who speaks first.
We're both oncologists, so we can take it in another perspective. I think one thing is the length of time you're associated with the patient as well. If you're associated with a very short period of time, that's one thing. If you've been that patient's physician over an extended period of time and going to other patients, I must admit, if I was going to a shivas or a funeral, I'd be going to hell with a lot of them. I treat leukemia, and my success rates are not always that great. So I think the only funerals I've ever gone to, in fact, were when I was also a member of the Chevra Kadisha, and I was involved in burying them at a later stage. But one thing I noticed colleagues who go to funerals, at least from oncologists, do it for a number of reasons. Number one is the length of time they've been associated. There may be a financial reason to go, as you see that patient or that family as donors to your hospital, or if you research or something like that, and then it's purely mercenary.
Okay.
I've also seen cases where there's been a degree of guilt on the patient or the property. The family's case is that patient was getting optimal care, and they maybe you were doing less than you were, and you go and gone on to make sure that give the baby, the family, committed to that patient over a period of time, and not. So there's a number of reasons people may go in a situation like that. I'm being very cynical. But I've seen those reasons.
I think all of them. I mean, the first point, certainly, for those who couldn't hear well, you know, Jeff made the point as an oncologist that, number one, unfortunately, death is frequent in the practice, and so there will be a lot of these to go to. But also, it does depend on length of time of knowing the patient. He also made the point that maybe some end up going more because the family are donors to the hospital, and therefore that may become a factor. I'm just reading the news. And then also there's the other issue here, which is it does send a message to the patient's family in case the family, and we're going to be talking more about this in a minute, if the family feels like maybe we didn't get the best possible care. Maybe they weren't that careful. The message of going to the funeral conveys a degree of emotional investment that may be reassuring to the family. I think that can be a part of it.
One of the things in the hierarchy of time, of the percentage of people who went to funerals, the highest was probably the family doctors who made up the longest association, and the shortest on the list, the intensivists.
Yeah.
Who may have a patient they don't know, who doesn't communicate with them in any way, they take care of the patient over a very short period of time before, unfortunately, they pass away from the very severe reasons of putting them in the ICU to begin with.
Right. I'm going to take Ellen's question or comment and then go a little further because there's a lot more to be said on this. Yeah.
Yeah, I think oncologists are a bit of a unique situation. I only just talk to oncologists, anybody involved in oncology, any healthcare professional. Like at one extreme, you have family doctors who, you know, they have this long-term relationship with the patient, but often like the end, the terminal period where the patient dies, they were handled by other people.
Mm.
Family doctor then is more of a support person, and
Yeah. All of these things are true, and I'm not in a position to judge anyone on this. I'm not, taking sides within it.
Just as an aside, from the opposite side,
yeah.
as a person who, I lost my dad suddenly, and I'm in that large boat, and my dad was a patient of a fellow doctor, who I'm not thinking that he's not here, but
okay.
He was my dad's a doctor for 40 years. Not a call. And I found that very upsetting as a daughter of a patient, of someone who died. So I can see from the other end, I'm not asking for him to come to the ship up, but he could have made a phone call.
Right.
And I think that hurt quite a bit. So I think it's nice if you don't have to go, I wasn't expecting funeral or ship up, but even a call saying, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Right.
So that it comes as on the other end.
I absolutely hear it. Look, the value within Judaism of going as chesed, as an act on behalf of the survivors, is I think very clear. At the same time, the need to protect yourself so that you can, if nothing else, be a good physician for more people and not shrink back from taking on cases because of anticipation of the pain that's going to be involved, I think that can't be discounted. In Judaism, we have a principle called Efshar L'Kayem Shneihem. When you have two mitzvot, right, and the question before of, well, one mitzvah may override the other, sometimes it's possible to satisfy both ends. And here, you may not be able to satisfy everyone and everything. It may be the case is actually too painful, or it may be this is somebody who you cared for 5 years ago, 3 years ago, and then there was, a gap in the continuity until the patient passed away, and is it really my patient, is it not? But the possibility of a compromise does exist. You mentioned the letter possibility. To me, the possibility of having a letter which has a basic form part of it to it, but then gets personalized, adding a detail about the patient, adding a detail about the relationship, something that shows a degree of thought and connection. If you can't go to the Shiva, at least to be able to send that letter may be something that would provide something for the family while retaining protection for the medical professional. I mean, there's so much more that goes into this. One of the things we didn't even touch on is the barrier that's also necessary professionally. In other words, we're trying to show emotion and to show a relationship. At the same time, there is such a thing as the professional distance, which has to figure in at some point as well. But a question that I was asked about in the run-up to this program was, what about when the survivors suspect the medical care that was provided? Where they feel like, in fact, a mistake was made, someone even was careless. I mean, I see cases of actual medical error, and I've also seen cases in which families have insisted that there was medical error, not that they had any evidence, but it must be. Obviously the pain that this is going to cause medical professionals is great, and frankly it can lead to professional problems as well. I think though that it's important to recognize three things from a Jewish perspective. One is general and two are Jewish. The one that's from a general perspective is to recognize this is often a function of the survivors coping with their own pain. And possibly their own feeling that they didn't do enough. We didn't find the right person. If we had chosen to do the surgery here instead of there, things would have been different. If we had gone to the hospital more often, the staff would have seen that we were there, and therefore they would have been more attentive. You've all heard the different things that people say. If you take a look at source number 16, paper entitled Death and Dignity, Exploring Physicians' Responsibilities After a Patient's Death. As literature on end-of-life care grows, more attention is also being paid to the importance of caring for bereaved family members, highlighting the need to continue to care for those left behind. In parallel, a newer body of work is emphasizing the importance of studying and avoiding harm associated with failures to maintain the respect and dignity of patients and their families. There is a drive to apply the methods of quality improvement to this realm in a similarly rigorous manner. manner as seen with, quote, never events such as wrong side surgery, falls in the hospital, or pressure ulcers. In other words, what the paper is talking about is avoiding traumatic events which can harm the feelings of the survivors. Things like, let's go back to Julie's case, having them show up in the room and find that their relative has passed away without any notification in advance. Those things, you know, avoiding those things is part of a body of work that's being done, as said here, on the importance of caring for the bereaved families afterwards. And in that sense, the physician should understand that the families are often expressing that grief that they're feeling after the loss of their loved one. The second point within it is that it's normal for professionals to have to defend themselves even when they've done nothing wrong. Because it's in the nature of human beings, forget medicine, it's in the nature of human beings in general to be suspicious. When something goes wrong, it's somebody's fault. Right? Even though reality is that things are often nobody's fault. But you want somebody to blame. Consider in the Torah, right? Moshe is blamed by Korach. Right? If you remember the story, Korach leads a mutiny against Moshe. You're taking too much power for yourself. Why are you always the one in charge? Why is your brother the high priest? And so on. When Moshe, like when you look at his career, takes nothing for himself and lives for the nation the whole way through. If you look in Nach, if you look in the prophets, you find that with Shmuel. Right? Shmuel feels the need. The prophet Samuel, at the end of his career of leading the Jewish people, he feels the need to give a speech in which he defends his record. He stands up in front of the people and he says, I want anybody who has a claim against me to say so right now. I have never taken anybody's animals. I have never taken anything from anyone. And in the end, a voice comes out, God's voice, as the commentators read it, and says, I testify to his innocence. Why did he need to make that whole show? What was that all about? Because people are always suspicious. It's the nature of human beings. And then third, there is within Judaism a recognition that a professional may need, and somebody who has responsibility for others, may need to defend himself, to defend herself. I brought you in source number, which one was it? Source number 17, a triple requirement that the Talmud mentions for a person to make sure that one's actions are above board. It quotes three different biblical verses to state that, ve'yisem nikiyim, you always must make sure that you are innocent in the eyes of the world. This has a practical element to it in source number 18, where the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, talks about tzedakah collectors. Community tzedakah collectors have an obligation to make sure they are above board. If the collectors are known to be righteous, if they're known as good people, they don't have to give an accounting, but it's a good idea for them to do so. If they don't have an established track record, then in fact they're required to give a public accounting of the money they collected and how they spent it. In other words, this is something that's standard for people to have to account for themselves. And as much as it's painful to deal with a family that's making an accusation of error that led to the death of their loved one, at the end of the day, it's human nature, and people have to expect that they may be in that position. Okay, that's in terms of that. I'm just watching the clock and realizing we've got 20 minutes and we have a couple of things still to go. Let me ask you a question. We've got two different topics left. One of them is responsibility for patient death and how Jewish law looks at that. We already had a long session a few years back on medical malpractice. It was in 2013. I have a link there, number 19. Should I go with that one first or jump to the issue of rituals and tearing kriya at the patient's death and those things first? Number four? Three?
Four.
Any... Four. Okay, so I'm going to go to four first, and then we're not going to miss out on three, but we'll spend some time on four first. So I'm jumping now to source number 25. Before we talk about kriya, about tearing one's clothing, I wanted to spend a minute on the topic of vidui. So vidui is, I suppose, a good translation for it, admission. To admit something, I would use the word confession, but that tends to confuse religions. But vidui, at its core, is a statement that a Jew traditionally makes at various times. Some, if you daven to Sfarad, say it on a daily basis. Others will do it on fast days. It comes up during the Slichos prayers that lead up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's done multiple times on Yom Kippur itself. The most popular format is the one where one strikes one's chest lightly and says, Ashamnu, Bagadnu, I've sinned this way, we've sinned that way. It's a declaration to God about the sins that we have performed. There is indeed a practice of reciting vidui before one passes away. There's a long form, there's an abridged form, and then there's a one-liner. The one-liner is one in which the patient says, if God forbid I pass away from this illness, may my death be an atonement for my sins. That's the one-line version of it. I didn't put a link for the text. I really ought to have put a link for the text of it. I should probably do that in the follow-up email. I'll send you a link to it where it can be found online. It is certainly available. The Talmud, when it introduces this, talks about the importance of speaking to the patient about what is about to be done, about this vidui, in a way that offers encouragement to the patient. So pointing out, many people have done this and have lived. This isn't a death sentence. This isn't we are abandoning hope of anything for you. But rather, it's a way to address God about things that you have on your record. I'll never forget, I was a young rabbi. I was, 24, 25 years old. And going into my first patient to whom I had to speak about vidui, and I had the hamadrich. Hamadrich is a guide that rabbis have with various standard prayers. And so I had the vidui one, and he was somebody who was still conscious enough and functional enough. He could read the Hebrew. He had the Hebrew knowledge, and I was about to hand him the hamadrich with the text after having given him the whole introduction. Many people have done this and lived and so on. And then I see at the last minute as I'm handing it to him that at the top of the page it says, make sure to introduce this by telling the patient that many have done this and lived. You don't want to disguise. I felt like if he sees that, it turns the whole thing into just formula. So I quickly slipped and tore the top of the page so that he wouldn't see that part of the text. And I handed it to him and he said the vidui. But you have to be careful not to do it in a way that causes the patient to abandon hope. I read an article by Rabbi Howard Jachter, which I'm actually going to quote a little bit later on, in which he noted a practice in a hospital in Yerushalayim, that there was somebody who would go to the hospital, to this, I don't know which unit it was, on a daily basis, every morning, and he would lead the patients collectively in vidui, saying, we're just going to do this. It's not saying that anybody in particular is going to die, but this way, everybody takes care of this, declaration. I thought that was a really interesting way to address the problem. But the question now is, someone's a medical professional. There's a patient who is ill, to the point where they think the patient may not survive. It may not be within a medical professional's role normally to carry this out. I'm aware that this could raise ethical issues if it looks like one is imposing anything on the patient, trying to convert the patient to something. Understood. Nonetheless, what one might be able to do is remind the family about the services of a chaplain being available, and if they're interested, refer them to someone. You have to know the patient, you have to have a relationship, clearly, in order to do this. But one thing that I think is very interesting is the question of what do you do if the patient is receiving opiates that could make vidui impossible? So how do you handle that? Meaning they're at a point where they're not going to be conscious. You're going to give them morphine and they're not going to be able to do the vidui properly. So it's very interesting. Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, in source number 25, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, you see the English on the top of the second side, is of the opinion that you don't give the patient morphine and the like until after they've done the vidui. He says, in my humble opinion, it appears there are several reasons to prohibit use of drugs and the like for a patient before he dies, and one of his concerns is vidui. However, he then quotes his father, Rabbi Yashiv, who says, nonsense. I laid out my arguments before my father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv. He did not accept them. He contended that logic dictates that if they would fulfill his request, meaning to give him the opiate and thereby ease his suffering and so extend the hours of his life somewhat, one should do this. One should not consider the points against them. He says, better to give them the medication. It could even prolong their life. How that works is its own discussion. But he's of the opinion that we do give the patient the morphine and we do not take vidui into consideration. What happens if the patient actually is unconscious? Is there value to reciting vidui on behalf of an unconscious patient? What would you say? I'm hearing yeses. Why yes?
They can't do something themselves.
So, if they can't do it themselves. But the formula of the vidui is to admit their own sins. You're admitting their sins?
No, admitting their sins for them. They can't do it.
Okay, no, I'm asking this as a serious question. Like, what's the mechanism by which this works? Judith, you're going to say?
The person who's reciting it feels they're doing something on behalf of the person who can't.
So it's almost for the sake of the person who's reciting it then?
Yes.
Okay. It was...
Why can't you change the grammar?
Change? Well, you can. The question is, can you change the meaning? Meaning, of what value is it for me to say so-and-so sinned? Usually we're against doing things like that. For me to say so-and-so has sinned, if so-and-so has sinned. So I'm going to come back, because I think I know where you're going with this, and I'm going in a similar direction with it. Alana. Right. So take a look at source number 26, please. This is the article by Rabbi Jaster that I mentioned before. He writes, in practice, I have heard that Rabbanim do lead a comatose patient in vidui. Indeed, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, states that if one cannot recite the vidui, he should think it in his heart. Comatose patients, for all we know, might follow the Rav's lead and recite it in their hearts. So that's one argument that is brought. But I think there's another argument to be brought, and it goes back to what you said, which is, we daven, we pray for people all the time, right? In fact, I mentioned the version of vidui that is most common, right? That is recited on Yom Kippur. Ashamnu, bagadnu, gazalnu. Is that singular or plural? It is plural, right? It describes how we have sinned, we have done. And children, when they first learn this text, always ask the question, there are items on this list that I did not do. But there are items on the list that they didn't do. Meaning, if you look at the list of things on the vidui, it includes theft. What if a person never took anything from anybody? It includes all sorts of sins that someone may not have done. However, it's worded in the collective, because the idea is we're part of a nation. And since we are part of a nation, we all bear responsibility for each other, and therefore, yes, we can apologize on behalf of each other, and if nothing else, it is a prayer on behalf of others, saying, God, I'm appealing to you to forgive so-and-so. And so in that sense, it may have value as well. So I think there are multiple reasons why one would do vidui even on behalf of somebody who is unconscious. There's certainly no loss in doing so. What about kriya? And again, keeping in mind what I said before about the medical professional and the need to make sure you're staying in bounds ethically. But that's a separate point. What about tearing kriya? If one is present at the time of the patient's death. So I brought you a number 27, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, that says that if you are present at the death of a Jew, you are indeed supposed to tear kriya. So why don't people? Because the practice in general is that medical professionals don't do this. So Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg offered a justification for it in source number 28. He actually offered two justifications. He says, first of all, if you were to tell people that if they're present, they have to tear, the result is you'd have a hard time finding people to be present. And we consider it very important to have people present at the time of death. We don't leave someone alone. So the greater value here is to make sure that you're going to have people there. So therefore, say, forgive the tearing. That's number one. His other point that he makes is that if you're wearing scrubs, they may not be yours. If they're owned by the hospital, you don't have the right to tear the hospital's clothing. Now, there's some discussion. You could tear the clothing that's underneath it, whatever. But that's his second. That's his second point. On the other hand, number 29, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said, absolutely not. He says, that's a pretty weak reason not to tear Kriya. He says, you're going to tell me that people are unworthy, that people would really refuse to be present because they would have to tear their clothing? He says, it can't be. He says, that's a justification for not protesting when people don't tear. However, if someone's going to ask him what should they do, his answer is that they should indeed tear kriya. As I said before, with all of this, please speak to your rabbi. But Rabbi Feinstein's position is that tearing should indeed be done. I'm just, because we're reaching, we have only several minutes left. I'm going to just get to the other area first, and then I'll stick around for discussion. I did want to know two things. If you came in late and didn't sign in, make sure you sign in on the sheets there. But also, number 30 on the sheet is an article by Rabbi Maurice Lamb, author of Jewish Way in Death and Dying, about other rituals that surround the time of death that are important to be aware of. I'm going to come back briefly to the issue of patient death and responsibility. The letter of the law in Judaism is that if somebody has proper training and acts in accordance with standard practice, they are exempt from liability for reasonable error. That's the basic principle. I brought you source number 20, the Tosefta, a core text in the Talmud. An expert doctor who treats with court authorization and causes harm is exempt in human law. God may hold them liable, but our courts do not. When he describes court authorization, that becomes known in later sources as board certification. That's what becomes accepted. Also, source number 21, an expert doctor who treats with court authorization harms accidentally is exempt. If he does it intentionally, he is liable. But otherwise, the exemption is for tikkun olam. Tikkun olam meaning improvement of the world. Specifically, if you're going to hold medical professionals liable when they make an honest mistake, they got all the training they were supposed to get, they did everything they were supposed to do, but they made a mistake because they're human beings, you won't have medical professionals. So therefore, they're exempt from liability. That's the that's what the Talmud states in this case. And in fact, that's the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 22. This applies specifically for error. This doesn't apply for negligence. And Dr. Nussbaum, you wanted a dentist case. So in number 23, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham notes, this won't apply. The case that he's describing here is a case of a dentist who drills the wrong tooth. And he says that if you should have known better, then indeed there is liability. If there's negligence, it's a different story. However, having said that one is indeed exempt from liability if they got the training and used the standard systems and the standard the best practices, the question is that it for Jewish law? Is nothing else going to be required of them? So I refer you to a very interesting responsum of the Chasam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, which I quoted a little bit of in source number 24. We've discussed it on other occasions. The question that he was dealing with was not a doctor question. His question was, there was a woman who had a maid working in her house, and the maid fainted. And the woman of the house went for the, whatever it was, brandy, schnapps, whiskey, whatever it was, thinking that she would revive her by putting some of that in her throat, and accidentally she grabbed instead kerosene. And the maid died. So this woman writes to Rabbi Sofer wanting to know, what's my responsibility now? What do I do? And his response to her is that, you know, you acted hastily, but that's because you're not a trained medical professional. a person who's not a trained medical professional does react hastily in a situation like that. It will be good to be prepared and to know what to do. But this is reality. A physician who acted hastily would not be exempt from liability. A layperson would indeed be exempt. However, he then writes what you see in number 24. He says, "Tzarich tzas tshuva." Some repentance is required, but don't burden her with too much. She was trying to save a life, and she was very confused. And if we would be strict, we would cause her to stumble regarding saving lives in the future. Right, the next time she sees somebody faint, she's running the other way. You need to make sure that people feel able to intervene. So he says, yes, you accept a level of responsibility, but not too much responsibility. And I think that the same thing may be true where the medical professional did everything they possibly could, got the training, did what you normally do, and made a mistake, or might have made a mistake. They don't know if it was a result of their error or not. The possibility of saying, I need to repent on some level, do something to correct this for the future, do some form of atonement, I think is a legitimate possibility within Judaism. So, okay, we've covered our four basic issues. I want to go back to the vignettes just to make sure that we're clear. So number one, in terms of leaving the Shiva, the answer is, if you can defer it, refer to somebody else or wait till after Shiva, that's good. But there is absolutely justification in Jewish law for seeing the patient during Shiva. We also talked about missing Kaddish and saying, if you're seeing patients through that time, providing medical services during that time, then you can hire somebody else to say Kaddish. That's legitimate, and that would suffice. We talked about the case of the patient passing away, going to the funeral, and noted the value that it may have, both in the general medical literature and in Judaism. At the same time, the challenges and the difficulty, and suggested that you should try perhaps to satisfy both sides of it by doing something, even if it's not actually being at the Shiva. We talked just now about liability for error and suggested that the professional is exempt from liability. However, maybe some tshuva, some repentance would be relevant. And then last, we asked about kriya and said that it seems like in the literature kriya should be done. There are those who say don't require kriya because it will cause people not to attend when somebody is dying. Some believe that that's a stronger exemption. Some argue it's not such a great exemption. And vidui, we said, if the medical professional can do this ethically to help with the vidui process, then yes, it's a good thing to do, even if the patient is not conscious. Questions and comments? Before we're not quite at the hour and a half mark. So, Heshi. In which case are you talking
about? First case, should one not leave the patient to say Kaddish? Should one not person who comes to you and should only say, is it permitted or is it mandatory?
Right, so I had written something into my notes, actually, that I didn't say out loud. I'm not sure why I didn't say it out loud. I think since one who is treating a patient is exempt from other mitzvot at that time, you're not allowed to leave the patient. I think that you would not be allowed to.
In the first case, the patient came to you, you shouldn't leave the Shiva, not that you can.
So there, because you're now operating in an environment in which it's standard to refer people, or to say to people, you can't get an appointment this week. If it's safe to do so, then I think you do it. I think that's standard protocol. You know, you would say the same thing if you were in the Bahamas that week. But if that's not the case, if you operate in an environment where you're dealing with patients who are seen when they, you know, when they need it for whatever reason, then I think that that's what you would do during Shiva as well. I think so. Cheryl, you were going to say. I guarantee you they've asked the question. Unfortunately, it's a practical question, yes. But that's what I've seen in the literature. Yes, last question. Yes.
Mm.
No, it's not, actually. I'm sorry. I skipped that, not intentionally. The requirement of tearing kriya, the requirement of tearing, is specifically that you had somebody who was fulfilling mitzvot in this world, and now that is lost, and therefore one tears clothing in an expression of grief over that loss. If it's somebody who rejected everything and has no interest in it, then there's no religious obligation to tear. And what he's saying is, you don't really know. How do you know about the patient? You're a medical professional. You're not their, you're not their confessioner, so to speak. To go back to the Vidui. You don't know what their status is. That's what he was. That's what he was referring to. So then, yeah, I'm not in the position of judging people's people's character. Okay. So, God willing, our next session is going to be in May. If you didn't sign in, please sign in, and you will get notification of that in due time. Thank you very much.